Hey everyone, you're listening to Coast and Coast Sports. It's been a bit of a wait. I am sorry for that. I apologize. I'm sitting here, and of course, with me is my man Kevin Chaney. We're about to talk some sports. For the listening masses, how you doing, Kevin?
I'm doing good, man. How you holding up?
Oh, you know, same thing. Different day. A lot of crazy stuff's been going on lately. We're about to talk about the NBA trades that have been taking place, and then take a look into the NFL Combine that just kicked off. But first, Kevin's going to lead us off here with a little bit of baseball talk. Kevin, go ahead. Tell us what's going on.
It's my favorite time of year. Baseball spring training has started. It's probably the only preseason in sports that I think actually matters. So the one thing that they're going to have to deal with that they've never really had to deal with at this level before is learning to play a different pace of baseball. Major League Baseball has decided that there are going to be 6 new rules in order to speed up the time of the game. Apparently, they're averaging somewhere along the lines of 3 hours and 5 minutes is the average baseball game, when just about 20 years ago, the average was 2.5 hours. So I understand why. But we're going to go over some of these rules that they're talking about. One, hitters must keep at least 1 foot inside the batter's box at all times. Pitchers must throw a pitch within 20 seconds of receiving the ball from the catcher. There will be clocks posted on the ends of each dugout so the pitcher knows his time. Maximum break between innings, this is my favorite because it cuts down on TV timeouts, is 2 minutes and 5 seconds. Now, the weird part about this is how they have it set up. Hitters must be in the batter's box by a minute 45. If the hitter's not ready, the umpire can call a strike. And if the pitcher doesn't throw the ball by 2 minutes and 5 seconds, the umpire has the right to call a ball. Get into that in a second. Teams have a maximum of 2 minutes and 30 seconds to change pitchers. Teams are limited to a maximum of 3 mound visits per game, not including pitching changes, and pitchers no longer have to deliver 4 balls for an intentional walk. All right, in theory, the idea of wanting to speed up baseball game, that's like everybody's biggest concern. Yeah. On top of every other sport except for football, the season being too long, according to, you know, the general public, they want to speed up the game.
Go.
But what I'm concerned about is the fact that baseball is the only sport, or at least one of the only major sport in America, where the clock does not dictate whether or not a team has won or lost. Baseball is a sport where you have to record every single out, no matter what, and there's no way for an umpire, unless it's one of these close calls at a plate, or you know, maybe they paint the corner of the strike zone, and somebody thinks that it was inside, somebody thinks it was outside. At the end of the day, clock has never had an impact on a baseball
game. Never been an issue with a running clock.
It's never been an issue, and that's part of the beauty of baseball. Baseball fans, true baseball fans, not even just, you know, I rep my city, but people that love baseball, they understand that. You can never look back at a team that wins a World Series and say, oh, well, they won, you know, because of this or that or that or this. No. 27 outs. You have to record all of them, and you only get that many opportunities to score runs. The idea, and I completely understand the idea of wanting to speed up a baseball game, especially in the dog days of summer in some of these places. It's just hot. You're outside. It's baseball. It's not constant entertainment like some of the other sports. But this is giving umpires an opportunity to put a strike on the board. 33% of your strikes can just go on the board because you threw a pitch at 2 minutes and 6 seconds instead of 2 minutes and 5.
Right, so they're essentially implementing a shot clock into the sport of baseball.
That's exactly what they're doing, and they're kind of alienating the sport a little bit by doing that, and they're doing it really easily and without much, doesn't seem like there's much concern about it. It's like, this is just what we're going to do.
Right.
This isn't what we're talking about. This is what we've done. So let's just change the entire game.
Well, how long have they been in discussions about this, if you might know? Were they talking about this, you know, prior to this upcoming season, like prior to last season, rather? Has this been something that have been bouncing around for a while?
Talking about speeding up a baseball game is very similar to all those years where everybody talked about a college football playoffs.
Sure.
There was always the conversation of what could we do? How could we do this without screwing it up, essentially? And they spent all that time hypothetically talking about it, to one day doing what they were trying not to do.
So you think that this is just going to taint the sport in a horrific way?
Well, the problem is that technically, in the rules, there is this shot clock, as you kind of like to put it, this pitch clock. It's technically in the rules, and it's just ignored.
Right.
Pitchers, batters, I mean, they will all agree to you. They don't really want that. That's just never been the heart and soul of the game.
Right.
If a pitcher can't get out of an inning, that's on him. If a pitcher takes 5 minutes to throw a pitch and he's just inside of his head, you know, second guessing himself, well, that's part of the game, unfortunately, right. Or fortunately. I think it's fortunate, but that's part of the game. You know, I'll go right back to being a homer, but last year in the ALDS, Baltimore against Detroit, each game in Baltimore, of the three games, two of them were in Baltimore, in both those games, in the seventh inning, Detroit liked to bring this reliever out, Joppa. And the first game, he came out, and the Orioles lit him up. Now, that was the team. Guaranteed, that was the team. They brought him back out the next day in the seventh inning, same inning, and the entire stadium lost their minds, yelling, screaming, cheering, chanting his name, and immediately he melted down again.
Right.
And there were times where he was just standing there and he looked visibly stressed out about throwing the next pitch.
Right.
The other problem with the pitch clock, and you know, I'll kind of put it up to this, is the fact that you warm up a pitcher. Now you're putting the time, you know, a relieving pitcher. You're putting the time on how long you have to change pitchers. So you're constricting how long they have to throw their warm-ups off the mound. But on top of that, with this pitch clock, you're also having to change when managers throw relievers up to warm up.
Right.
You're making the things that are changing, and the reason I don't think people are going to be too concerned about it is because it's the things that if you're not a true fan of every aspect of the sport, not just the actual play, but the entire aspect of the sport, they're not things that you're going to think are going to matter. But all of a sudden, if, you know, the benefits of having a younger or an older team, to be completely honest with you, but the discipline will need to be there for the younger players, and they will need to be immediate. They'll need to be very aware of what's going on. And then the older guys, well, are they going to be able to pitch as long anymore?
Right.
Because if you're telling them that they're going to have to throw within this timeline instead of getting everything straight and making sure that everything's, you know, blase that a pitcher has to go through for his shoulder and his elbow, you're kind of shortening careers in a way, or at least it could. It has the potential to shorten the usefulness of an older pitcher.
Do you feel like that this pitch clock is something that's going to be around for a while, or is this kind of like, let's just see how it goes for the season? If it works, great. If it doesn't, back to the drawing board, we'll figure something else out.
It's honestly going to depend on the ratings. If the ratings are there, if more people are watching, if the World Series and playoffs in general and the All-Star game, they're getting more people to watch, then it's here forever. It'll
right.
never, ever die. In
right.
fact, it might constrict more. They're talking about it next year, shortening or shrinking the strike zone, making the strike zone smaller.
Yeah.
Next year, they want to make the strike zone smaller, and the reason for it is because they want people to watch more. People aren't watching as much because they've cracked down on steroids hard enough that you're not getting all these home run champions anymore. You're not getting these guys hitting 50 home runs a year anymore. You're getting back to averages that make sense. These, you know, right around 300. You're getting these guys that they're not hitting 40 and 50 home runs.
Right.
A good home run hitter is hitting somewhere between 25 and 35.
Right.
And that's not – baseball is losing audience for that. So they're talking about shrinking the strike zone to get more players on base. It's probably going to stick around because if the runs go up, the viewers stick around.
Right.
If the games are shorter, people want to go more. People want to watch more. People don't mind as much. Unfortunately, I think it's going to probably stick around forever. And it breaks my heart, but I don't know if it breaks the world's heart.
But isn't that one of the true beauties of baseball for a true fan? Maybe not so much on TV because, I'll openly admit it, it's very painful for me to sit and watch an entire 4-hour anything on TV. I don't care what kind of game it is.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't it kind of the beauty to, you know, you're going to the ballpark with your pops or whatever, and you buy your tickets, you go in there, you're in the stadium, you get the, you know, the smell of the grass, all the things that come with being at a live game, and there's no time limit. You know that you're going to be there for at least 3 hours, maybe longer, and it's just this great, like this all-day experience. Why would you remove that from it?
That's why all these stadiums, you know, it's not just the field and the stands, and then, you know, right outside the stands, there's some concessions, and that's it. You go to Baltimore, you go to Fenway, or the new Yankee Stadium.
Sure.
It has an entire park on its own, just dedicated to its Hall of Famers and its Yankee legends.
Yeah.
In San Diego at Petco Park, they did a tremendous amount to make being inside the park just as much of an experience as watching the game and sitting in your seat.
Right.
And that's exactly what it is. I don't ever want to say that I don't want to sit there and watch an entire baseball game, because I do. But when you go to the ballpark, they happen to be playing a baseball game.
Sure.
You know, but you can walk around. The history of that team is represented through that stadium in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
From statues to hallways to pennants to,
right,
to trophy cases.
And I guess my thing is this. Like, I live about 4 blocks away from AT&T Park, right? I am right down the street from it. And when there's a game on, I mean, it's kind of like the thing to do for the casual fan. To just, like, you know, third inning, fourth inning, all right, I'm going to go pick up a ticket and just walk inside and just go check it out. Like, just go see what's going on. And I like being able to do that. And the only way you are able to do that is because the game takes so long. You can just kind of enjoy your entire day at the park. Now, I don't want, I guess the thing that, in my mind, the way I see the negatives from a shortened game is, yeah, on a TV standpoint, that's probably better. But for a live standpoint, like, I want to be there and enjoy the full experience. I don't want it to be my time to get cut short. That's not what I'm paying for.
Exactly. Exactly. And when I watch a baseball game, you know, as an Orioles fan, this is the first time in my, you know, adult life that the Orioles have been consistently good. I don't ever want to think that there's a chance that this team was built around a system that no longer exists, and so suddenly this team's consistency is taken away.
Right. Right.
You know.
And the other thing that I would, I thought was pretty interesting that you brought up was the whole, the pitch count thing. Without it, there's that mental battle going on a mound between, you know, within the pitcher's own mind. And when you brought that up, I kind of immediately thought of, like, that almost being the equivalent of, you know, in basketball when the guy's at the free throw line to tie or win a game. And,
yep,
yeah, there's a timer. He can't just sit there forever. But it's an extended amount of time. And I've never seen a guy get, you know, I've never seen the ref be like, "Oh, you've been on the line too long." And you can see it. Like, the cameras zoom in. The guy's,
yep,
sweating. People are going crazy. They're cheering. They're trying to rattle him. And it's a critical moment. And if it wasn't for that long period of time, what would a free throw be? There's no hype. There's no drama. There's nothing like that. It's just another
suspense.
Shot.
There's no suspense.
There's no suspense. Exactly. There's no suspense.
A couple years ago, World Series, St. Louis Cardinals versus Texas Rangers. Okay. Game 6. A player from, born and raised in St. Louis, playing for the Cardinals, extra innings, David Freeze is up. It's extra innings. If the Rangers win, that game, the series is over.
Right.
If you tell me that David Freeze doesn't get the opportunity to hit that ball to take it to Game 7 and ultimately become the World Series MVP and win the World Series for his hometown, he doesn't get the opportunity to do that because he was not in the batter's box at a minute 45 or after a minute and 45 seconds because it's Game 6, bottom of the 10th or 11th, whatever it was, of the World Series, and you are potentially the last out and you go home? The point is that the moment is just as big for pitchers and batters as it is for fans, for managers, for announcers. It's electrifying. You know, the cliche, it's the bottom of the 9th, 2 outs, bases loaded, down 3. I mean, that's a real potential scenario, and it's probably the heaviest scenario in sports. And a lot of it is because of the fact that it's a little bit drawn out.
Right.
You can't, it's not this thing that just all of a sudden it happens and then it's over.
Right.
You have to be aware of the moment and then you take hold of it.
Sure. Yeah. Well, we'll see how this plays out. And
it's going to be really interesting. It's going to be really interesting to see the growth of this plan, to see how the umps and the players react to it, how they adhere to it. And, overall, whether or not it actually does make an effect on the game or not.
It's right around the corner. We're going to get a glimpse of it real soon. Real, real soon. All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and take a quick break. You've been listening to Coast to Coast Sports. I'm Shane, and of course, along with me is Kevin, and we'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. All right, everybody, welcome back. You've been listening to Coast to Coast Sports. My man Kevin just got done talking about baseball and the potential rule changes that are coming forth, and I'm going to go ahead and dive into what just took place in the NBA. A lot of trades, most of them last minute. So the other day was pretty exciting for hardcore NBA fans. I know I was all about it. My Portland Trail Blazers went and got their hands dirty, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. But first, the first trade that really stood out to me was that between the Kings and the Wizards. A straight-up trade for two guards. The Kings acquired Andre Miller, and the Washington Wizards got Ramon Sessions. And the reason why I feel like this one stands out a little bit, which in any other case, it wouldn't. These are two guys that, you know, kind of fly under the radar. But George Karl, you know, he gets the job coaching for the Kings. Third coach in one season. Pretty unbelievable, but hey, true story. And he wants to implement his system. Now, if George Karl is going to implement his system, he wants to implement his system with somebody who's played in it. And who better than Andre Miller? He was a guard for him for a while when he was over there with the Nuggets. So he's bringing over Miller, and I think that's a good move for the Kings. I don't know if the Wizards are really going to benefit much from getting Sessions. I mean, he's a solid backup guard, playing behind John Wall, and maybe he can play a little bit of a swing position, maybe could play off the ball at the two spot. I'm not sure, but really, I think that the winner here was the Sacramento Kings, simply because Andre Miller is going to be the coach on the court. And you know, like I said, it's always good to have someone in your locker room who's been there, done that with a certain coach, kind of familiar with what it is that they're going to be doing, so he can kind of pass it along to the other guys. It's going to be very, very fun to watch George Karl coach the likes of DeMarcus Cousins, who I think is the best center in the NBA right now. I'm a big fan of Cousins. I'm a big fan of the Kings, to be honest with you, Rudy Gay and those boys.
Hey, where's he from?
Where's he from?
Rudy Gay. He's from Maryland. Don't worry, I got you.
Is he now?
He is.
Yeah, well, okay, Homer, whatever. It's cool. I'm gonna quiz me like that now. I don't know where this man's from. I'm not his friend. But yeah. So I think the Kings got better with that. Maybe not so much from a talent perspective, but from a teaching perspective. You got to have somebody in the locker room who is a veteran, who knows the game, who's been in those playoff situations, and who can help get you there, if by no other way than by mentoring the young studs coming up. So that's good. I like that trade. I like that trade a lot.
All right.
One trade that I thought was a bit of a joke, and it keeps me laughing. It seems like the 76ers are trying to get worse. It really does. They went out and acquired.
Which seems like such a harder task than being better.
it seems so blatant that they're trying to get worse and worse. They went out and acquired JaVale McGee. Now, JaVale, he's not a bad player. Don't get me wrong. I'm not taking anything away from his skill set. In fact, a couple of years ago, I thought that he could have been a perennial all-star. But talk about going out and just getting somebody who's going to be on, you know, the injured reserve list throughout the better part of his career. That's basically what they did by acquiring JaVale McGee. Now, I get it. They also got a first-round protected lottery pick that the Nuggets had that was originally from the Thunder. So that's going to help them in the future, except for the fact that the 76ers have shown over the last few years that they really don't know what they're doing when it comes to the draft. They really don't. And then this acquisition of JaVale McGee as well is laughable at best. I decided we'd just touch on it a little bit just because I feel like it's pure comedy and I love it. I kind of wish that it was one of the Trailblazers' rival teams that was continuing doing this because it would be even that much more beautiful to me. But yeah. It's not. It is what it is. It's an East Coast team. Maybe this will affect you a little bit more considering, you know, you're out there rooting for them Wizards. I'm assuming the Wizards is your team. I mean,
they are. And we're really excited about not being the worst mediocre team. We are now one of the better mediocre teams in basketball.
You are one of the better mediocre teams. You're right on the razor's edge of above average.
Being good. We're so close to being good.
But so I thought that one was pretty funny. Now, here's one that I do want to dive into a little bit deeper. The Clippers went ahead and picked up Austin Rivers. Normally, I wouldn't have a problem with them going out and picking up Rivers, except for the fact that it seems like a move that they made strictly to save the career of the son of the head coach. Austin Rivers has been unspectacular, to say the least. He came into the league with a lot of people having high expectations for him to deliver the goods. He hasn't done it. Now he gets picked up by the Clippers, and it seems like it's one of those situations where it's daddy to the rescue. Now, this is a hard topic to talk about because we're talking about a father and son situation, and I don't want to get into too much of a personal level, but it's something that can't be ignored. I don't think that this was just a complete, I'm doing this for the betterment of the team. I don't think Doc Rivers did that. I think that it was strict. I think that there was a lot of, I want my son playing under my wing kind of a thing. Because Austin Rivers, like I said, he's been unspectacular. He's been a bit of a disappointment, to be blunt about it. And it seems like, you know, here comes dad to the rescue. I'm going to go ahead and resurrect my son's career and turn him into at least something and put him on a team that is, even though they're not going to contend for a title because they've been a serious disappointment in my eyes, but they are a title contender right now. They just are. They're a strong team in the West. I don't like the move. It rubs me the wrong way. It bothers me. It makes me uncomfortable to see because here's the thing. If Austin Rivers goes to the Clippers and underperforms, doesn't do well, doesn't live up to expectations, how does that look on Doc Rivers? One. And two, how are the other players supposed to approach their coach, who is the dude's dad, and say, hey, so-and-so is not getting the job done. We need to make a move. We need to make something happen. I don't think they're going to feel comfortable doing that. I can't picture Chris Paul or Blake Griffin or DeAndre Jordan going to Doc Rivers and saying, hey, man, your son's just not, he's not working out here. You need to make something happen.
Well, I would agree with you, but also I'm not 100% sure that it's necessarily the players that would need to do that. I think most people would agree. It would be very hard to, it'd be very hard to criticize Doc Rivers given his resume.
Which,
you know,
is impeccable.
He's obviously a phenomenal basketball coach. But the other thing is that his son, he played lights out basketball for Duke.
He did.
He came into the league, and just because he came into the league and wasn't immediately lights out, I think it's a fair bet that, you know, the experience that he has with his son's game and the potential ability that he would have, or the special ability that he would be able to have because of that relationship to nurture that game and make it better and make him either an active contributor to the team or a stud on the team. I think that if anybody's going to be able to do that, Doc Rivers would have an advantage in that. Sometimes you get to the pros and you can think all day long that you're going to be able to keep up with the speed of the game and that you're going to be able to make that adjustment, and some people just don't make it immediately.
Right.
That's not to say that he's not going to. I would be hard pressed to say that the upside, not on a media standpoint, point, obviously, if you were to take that completely out of the picture, the upside of bringing Rivers in is bigger than the downside. You didn't waste your first-round draft pick on him. You didn't waste, you know, that scouting and all that. You didn't waste that time on him. But now he's on your team.
Right.
So, I think there's the upside is definitely big enough that it makes sense currently.
I think that one of the greatest downsides that is a result of this is that it is automatically going to draw a lot of attention. I mean, they're going to be talk about being under a microscope. Now it's like this father and son situation where people were talking about it. Nobody. All right, here's the thing. You're right about giving him time to develop out of college. It's a different ball game in the pros, this and that. People that come out of Duke generally come into the NBA and become really good role players, i.e. Shane Battier. Remember that. Like, he was the man at Duke. Comes into the NBA. Everybody knew he was not going to be the man anywhere. He was going to be, you know, a pivotal key to a championship contender. And there are a lot of other players in the past that have come out of Duke that are the same way. That's what I expect out of Austin Rivers coming out of Duke. He hasn't done that. I don't think that he's – I don't see a high ceiling for this. I think the ceiling is relatively – I think he's – I don't want to say he's reaching his peak, but I don't see him ever making it into, like, an all-star game. I don't ever see – there being a time when somebody's like, man, thank God we got Rivers on the team, or else we wouldn't have gotten to this point. You know, I just don't see it. Before Klay Thompson developed into the Klay Thompson that he is today, the all-star, he was expected to be a pivotal role player playing alongside of Steph Curry, to be able to deliver that deep three, to be able to lock down on defense. And he did exactly that. Almost immediately. Now, granted, his talent level is much higher, and we see that now because he, like I said, he's a star, and he's just an absolute stud. The same thing with Wesley Matthews in Portland, though, who went undrafted. He was expected to just kind of play a role. You've got, you know, you're a sharpshooter from outside the arc, and you're a hustler, and you can play defense. Just do those three things, and everything will be just fine. And he has done exactly that. I think that's what they wanted out of Austin Rivers coming out of Duke. He didn't deliver the goods. His dad brings him over now to the Clippers, which I'm fine with, except for the fact that now the media is going to be all over that, regardless of how the Clippers season goes. And right now, they're in an even worse position because the expectations for the Clippers for this season was to make it to the NBA Finals.
Right.
Right now, they are looking like they're going to get bounced out of the first round, the way they're playing, by pretty much anybody they're facing. It doesn't matter. Health has been an issue. They haven't played like a team. They haven't really gelled at all. I expected a lot more. I mean, I think I talked to you kind of, you know, outside of the show. They were my preseason pick to go to the finals. I had them in Chicago making it into the finals. Now I have to change that pick because it's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. But that's just how I feel about it.
Austin Rivers, I kind of think back to J.J. Redick. J.J. Redick was coming out of Duke. He was a senior, and he broke a bunch of records. He was shooting threes like you couldn't freaking believe.
Right.
He got into the league, and he has been that. He has been a great supporting member of a team. He still shoots an okay three, but he's also one of those guys where everybody kind of hyped what his transition was going to be going into the league a little bit, first-round draft pick. And he's he's just as good. He still shoots just as good of a three, but he was never really going to be the best player in the NBA.
No. Oh, you know, absolutely.
Austin Rivers, there is a lot of potential for him to be a great number two guy, a great number three guy for your team, a guy that can score points, you know, can have his good nights if he's in the right system. You know, I just think it's too soon to – I think it's too soon to write him off for one. I definitely think it's too soon to judge Doc when there are definitely real reasons why him having brought on his son, who possesses a certain amount of potential, onto a team that is kind of underperforming.
Right. Well, I agree with you on the – I mean, I don't want to just write off Austin Rivers as being talentless. I mean, the dude can play, but I don't think that he'll ever reach that level that people thought that he was ever going to reach. And I respectfully disagree with you with the whole Doc Rivers thing. I don't like it. It just – I'm not saying that it was the wrong decision from a basketball mind standpoint. I just think – I don't like the idea of not just acquiring your son, but, like, you know, making an effort in a trade rather than it being, say, a free agency type thing where it's like, oh, he's available, let me pick him up. I think I would have liked that a little bit more than, you know, having it have been, we got to give something up for him.
Well, if that had been the case, everybody would have been judging his contract.
Well, yeah, you that's true. Like, yeah.
There were definitely some lose-loses for...
Well, I mean, there you go. There's no winning way. There's no win. I don't think there's a winning situation when father and son, you know, go together. Unless, of course, father's a great coach and son is an amazing player, which is not the case this time. It's a great coach and a, you know...
Okay guy.
An okay kind of role player. And, yeah, the last trade that I wanted to talk about, just because it's my team and I can talk about it, you know, it's our show. I kind of have the controls here, so whatever. But
you can do that.
Yeah.
Better than having your own show, right?
Portland picked up Aaron Aflalo from Denver. Denver, man, they seem to be cutting bait with a lot of guys, which I'm okay with because they had a lot of individual talent that didn't flow together as a team. So I kind of like their strategy of just getting rid of guys right now. But yeah, Portland, they acquired Aaron Aflalo along with Alonzo G in exchange for Will Barton, Victor Claver, and Thomas Robinson, as well as a 2016 first round lottery pick with some red tape attached to that. Honestly, as a diehard Blazer fan and a guy who's been following the team for the better part of the last, I don't know, 10 years or so, like closely, I say this is a pretty damn good move. Aaron Aflalo is a great swing player. He can play at the two, he can play at the three. He has starting potential. He has starting talent, not potential. He has starting talent, but he'll be coming off the bench. I think that Neil O'Shea, the general manager for Portland, has proven that he knows exactly what he's doing. I mean, he helped build the Clippers. When was the last time anybody was talking about the Clippers the way they are now?
You know, just not.
Yeah.
Not in a positive way.
It was
the
Lakers and that other team that shared the building. So he helped build the Clippers. So when I heard that he was taking a job with Portland, I got pretty excited about it. And he has proven to be that, I don't want to say basketball genius, but he has proven to be a very wise man when it comes to personnel moves. He acquired Chris Kaman and Steve Blake over the summer, and they have been huge, huge pivotal role players coming off the bench. And I think Aaron Aflalo is another great pickup, so I'm really excited to see how the team does moving forward. I also think that this is a kind of a sign that Portland is in the win now mindset. They knew that their bench was pretty weak. You know, I like Will Barton. He didn't really put up numbers. I love Thomas Robinson. If anything, that kind of hurts me a little bit because, my God, this dude's so athletic and so fun to watch and such a hard hustler and just a good guy. But, I mean, you know, they decided to go a different way, and you can't always have everything that you want. So this is the result. But overall, I'm happy. I think it's a good trade. And, yeah, man, trade deadline always brings about for the NBA, the trading deadline is one of the more exciting times because you know some things are going to be shaken up. And, boy, they were just coming one after the other. I mean, I woke up. I went to sleep the night before the deadline. And not much was going on. Woke up the next day and about, you know, 30 guys had moved. So, really exciting time.
Right. That's what happened to everybody, I think.
Yeah, really, really exciting time to be an NBA fan. So, this is it. All-Star break is over. Trade deadline is passed. This is the home stretch. This is the final battle to kind of lock in your playoff seed. And then we're getting into the fun stuff, man, the playoffs. So, that's it. And that's it.
Basketball.
All right. So now it seems like another great time to take a break. I'm going to go ahead and grab some water. and, do my thing. But when we come back, we'll be talking NFL Combine. Excited to dive into that. Football never sleeps, man. Football never sleeps.
Never, ever stops.
All right, you're listening to Coast Sports. All right, everyone, welcome back once again to Coast Sports. Talked a little baseball, just got done talking about the NBA trades that just took place, and now we are talking about the NFL Combine, which is just kicking off now. And Kevin and I both have a couple of prospects that we are particularly interested in and keeping our eyes on. Kevin, go ahead, give us yours.
Baltimore has a big problem right now, the Ravens do, when it comes to this draft. A lot of players are under contract, but last year they signed Dennis Pitta to a very nice contract, but he, without physical contact, re-aggravated that hip injury. While they claim it's healed, nobody is sure whether or not he's ever going to play another down of football again. So with that being said, there's two guys that I'm actually looking forward to watching during this combine. That is Minnesota's Max Williams and Penn State's Jesse James. They're not exactly the same type of tight end. Max Williams is definitely somebody that's a little bit more dynamic down the field, but as the Ravens are getting with this new offensive coordinator, they're only in their third year of using the zone blocking scheme for their run. It would be really interesting to see if they would go and draft a tight end in a Max Williams or Jesse James. Jesse James is more blocking. Jesse James is definitely somebody that can catch a ball for short yardage. If I'm not mistaken, he's averaging 13.3 yards a catch, which isn't bad by any stretch of the imagination, but it's going to be interesting to see how his speed actually breaks down, how his vertical breaks down, even though he is 6'7". Not really sure how much more, how bad his vertical could be.
Right.
But Max Williams is probably the most anticipated tight end currently coming out of the draft, and he's a stud. It will be fun to watch his combine. It's not an underrated position, but as rules in the NFL are starting to gear more towards high-powered offenses and towards wide receivers in general, you do kind of worry about the receiving tight ends not, taking away the fact that Gronk just won a Super Bowl, obviously. But other than Gronkowski, who are the tight ends that are really out there that are the game changers? Ram, you know what I mean?
Right. Well, now, here's my question for you as far as, crazy game-changing tight ends. Now, I know that Seattle's a bit of a different kind of offense.
Mm-hmm.
But they do have a lot of plays that run to their tight ends, and they don't really have any big-name tight ends. I mean, Zach Miller obviously went down about mid-season with a season-ending injury. Zach Miller, he's not fast. He's a big dude with soft hands, which is nice. I mean, to me, the tight end position is kind of like hit the escape button. If the play breaks down, you can always find a reliable tight end right there, which is what Tony Romo has been doing with Jason Witten for years now. Are you looking for like a breathtaking, game-changing Jimmy Graham-type tight end, or just somebody who you can rely upon who's not going to get hurt, who's got good hands and solid blocking ability?
Joe Flacco seems to have a style of play that says that if he's getting his ball to his tight end, then he's getting the ball, then he's able to get the ball to everybody else. Joe Flacco likes to throw to the middle of the field, but he hasn't had that wide receiver with the exception of Anquan Boldin, and that was, he was obviously coming towards a little bit, starting that later era of his career. But he hasn't really had that guy that does just go up, get the ball, and fall forward.
Right.
Which is the biggest thing for him, because if Joe Flacco's not throwing the ball 5 yards, he's throwing it 40 yards.
Right.
So, game-changing tight end, absolutely not. But with the exception of Dennis Pitta, Joe doesn't have... When Dennis went down, nobody stepped up and said, I can also do this.
Right.
Torrey Smith has better games when Joe Flacco can throw the ball to a tight end. Ray Rice had better games when even receiving and running, when tight ends in the middle of the field, when linebackers could not just move forward, and when people couldn't just sit back, Joe Flacco was having better games. They need somebody that is strong, has an okay step, but can definitely come off some blocks and then to go out and receive a pass, and that can get hit while catching a ball.
Right.
Because Joe doesn't hide the fact that he likes to throw the ball in the middle.
Well, how about, okay, you're looking at these guys out of the draft, which is fine. That's what we're talking about. But just to throw kind of a wrench in the equation here, what about the idea of maybe picking up Julius Thomas off of free agency?
It's the money. That's the problem with that. The Ravens, when they dedicated all that money to Joe Flacco and they've just done some to Terrell Suggs, they're probably going to dedicate a good bit of money to Haloti Ngata, and then you still have to talk about Torrey Smith. There's just not the money for it.
Right.
So, I would love if Julius Thomas were able to come to this team for no money, then absolutely.
I'm assuming that you would probably say the same thing about Jordan Cameron, who's also a prospective free agent. Right.
This team, there's a fun little topic of conversation about Brandon Marshall and John Harbaugh having talked during the All-Star game, and all of a sudden there was a big blow up about, oh my God, we're getting Brandon Marshall. No, we're not getting Brandon Marshall. If the Ravens are getting a new wide receiver,
right,
it's either a new contract for Torrey Smith,
right,
or through the draft.
Right. Yeah. Fair enough. I mean, it is funny. I mean, again, we're talking about the combine, but just real quickly to touch on it, it is funny when you see it takes one little nugget to blow up into a huge thing swirling around the rumor mill about getting a potential, star landing on your team. Like, lately it's been for Seattle, the whole talk about Ndamukong Suh, which, don't get me wrong, I would love nothing more than to have Ndamukong Suh on that defensive line. God, I mean, talk about an elite defense. But, I mean, the dude's franchise tag alone is something like $26 million. There's no way Seattle can afford him. So, yeah, I feel your pain on that. It's funny, but it's also laughable. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's the fun / the depression of the NFL offseason.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's what makes it great.
You just got to take whatever you can get and run with it for most people, I guess. But
exactly. So, is there anybody else that you kind of got your eyes on, or is that about it?
Yeah, tight end is just what I'm, everybody's going to hype up the quarterbacks. Everybody's going to hype up on wide receivers. Everybody's going to talk about your running backs. My thing is I like to see about, teams like Baltimore, teams like Seattle, Dallas, they have the core. They're looking for support pieces. They're looking for people that can, you want to talk about immediate steps. Unless you have an Odell Beckham Jr. that comes out and has insane season.
Right.
The support for teams like that, teams that are very close to being, or staying in contention, are these supportive roles. And these are the guys that tend to get drafted and become much better players than they maybe would have if all of the weight was to be put on their shoulders immediately.
Yeah.
These guys, I look at tight ends because when you have a team that's going to draft a tight end, it's never drafting a tight end because he is going to lead the league in touchdowns.
Sure. Well, I'm just kind of going over what's going on with the tight ends right now, and looks like Blake Bell out of Oklahoma, tight end, just ran a 4.8 40. Maybe somebody you want to keep your eyes on.
And that's just insane.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty damn impressive for a tight end. So
pretty damn impressive for a tight end.
Yeah. Just kind of looking at the list right now. Blake Bell ran a 4.8, and I don't even want to try and pronounce this kid's name. tight end out of Southern Illinois, just ran a 4.5. Wes Saxton, a 4.6. So it looks like for teams looking for a tight end, I mean, of course, these are just 40 times, but it looks like the pool is pretty deep.
Some of this new NFL has done. I mean, tight ends are expected to be a little more productive on the pass game now.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, Jimmy Graham is not slow by any stretch of the imagination. No. You know, Thomas is not slow in relation to anybody either.
Right.
But the difference is being able to, you know, you got to draft a good player, and you got to draft a player that's good for your system. Max Williams, I think, would do well in the Baltimore system, but Jesse James, I think, would also do well. Just, I mean, his size, 6'7", 254.
Yeah.
You know, just his size would do very well for the running game that Baltimore's been implementing for the last few years here.
Absolutely amazing. Yeah.
And I'm sure Joe Flacco appreciates it.
Yeah. Well, me, you know, I got my eyes on the combine, but a little bit differently. I mean, the guy that I really wanted to see perform likely will not be, and that is Todd Gurley. Just read an article by that's on NFL.com. Chase Goodbread wrote about his knee rehab may take 6 to 9 months. You know, for those listening to refresh their memories, he did tear his ACL, which is why his name hasn't been bounced around a whole lot lately. Although he is still expected to be the first runner taken in the draft, which I think is interesting, considering a kid who's got a torn ACL is still thought to be that good to the point where teams shouldn't overlook him and still take him as a first running back in the draft. Now this is kind of hard for me to talk about, a little hard for me to say, but I am a diehard Hawks fan, and my wounds have not fully healed yet. Thanks for asking.
I thought I'd been being very polite not bringing it up.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's amazing how many people have approached me and talked to me as if somebody passed in my family. they're just like, oh, man, are you okay? Is there anything that we can do?
Are you okay,
like,
man?
My door.
I can come over. Let me come over.
If there is anything I can do for you, let me know. My door is always open. That's what I've been hearing. I've been hearing a lot of that. But as much as it hurts for me to say this, I think that it is time for Seattle to part ways with Beast Mode. I think we've reached that time. I think it is. I think now is the time for the transition from Marshawn to I don't know who. And here is my reasoning. Okay. A. I love Marshawn Lynch as a person. His running style is nasty, physical, hard. I don't need to explain it. There's a reason why they call him Beast Mode. I do not want to see this man walking around brain dead by the time he's 35, 40 years old. Because if he keeps playing into his later years the way he plays, because you know he's not going to change his run style for anyone, I think that's what we're looking at. B, it's... Russell Wilson's about to get a fat contract, a ridiculous contract. I don't know what it is, but everyone's saying, like, be prepared. Seattle's about to dump a lot of money into this man's pocket, and I think he deserves every penny. I don't think that Seattle needs to get away from the physical run game, but I think they need to perhaps put the ball in Russell's hands a little bit more than what they have been in the past. Because let's just be honest, how often do players like Marshawn Lynch come around? Not very often. I would love to see him stay. I really would. But at the same time, I'm looking at it from a money perspective, for one. They just need to clear up some of that cap space. They're hurting right now. And, man, Seattle needs some wide receivers. And I would love to see them go out into the free agency and pick one or two up. But, I mean, should they re-sign Marshawn to a contract that is, by all accounts, pretty lucrative, they're not going to have money to do anything. Between him and Wilson, and then they got a few other free agents coming up that I would like to see stay, like Maxwell, I seriously doubt that Byron Maxwell's coming back. But there are other free agents that need to be locked up. I do not want Seattle to invest a ton of money into a running back who has been having chronic back issues this last year, who, I mean, it's also hard to tell where his head's at right now. I feel like if he really wanted to play football, he would have come out and said, I'm coming back next year already. He would have already said it. It's just me. I don't want to see the team invest that much money in someone who's on the fence about playing in the first place, whose back is kind of questionable at this point, who's getting to that golden age of 30. You know, that's the magic number for running backs, I guess, if you're if you're into numbers like that, where they start to hit the decline in their careers. I love Marshawn. I love what he's done for the club, but I just think at a certain time, everybody needs to part ways with their favorite guy. It happens to every team. You can't avoid it. I think that time has come for Seattle, and I think Todd Gurley is the replacement. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, so you think Todd Gurley is the replacement.
Yes.
And Seattle is one of these teams that I kind of have on this very controversial radar. If Marshawn Lynch were to not be a Seattle Seahawk next year, in very little money, Seattle strikes me as a team that may try out a Ray Rice.
You think so?
Well, so what you're, you know, okay. Yes, there's a little bit of bad, there's a fair bit of bad publicity coming out of Seattle right now because of the controversy of the Super Bowl and all that other type of stuff. But with all that aside, if there is a head coach that I think could play the spin correctly about signing Ray Rice, it would probably be Pete Carroll.
Yep.
If there's a guy that's probably willing to give a guy a second chance, it's probably going to be the front office of Seattle.
Right.
If there's a group of fans that would be able to eventually, of course, based on play, but eventually, you know, support this guy, and if there's a group of fans that he would want to feed into, because Ray Rice was all about Ravens Nation. He really was. He was all about the community, being with the fans, giving back. Like, not to defend Ray Rice, but people like to forget about the fact that he had an extra 2 weeks of contract negotiations with the Ravens because he wanted more money on his bonus, and every penny of that extra money that he argued for went to local charities in Baltimore.
Well, no, I mean, I've heard by all accounts that he was a great guy, and this just happened to be something that was so out of character. People were like, wait, who did it?
Correct. But with that being said, the upswing to all that is you're going to get Ray Rice for damn near free.
Right.
Whoever gets him, they're going to get him for practically free.
Right.
He is desperate to get on a football field and desperate not to have his career end this way.
Right.
I think a team like Seattle, their physical running, the way Ray Rice is able to be, he's incredibly versatile, or at least he was. We'd have to see what a year out of the league is doing to him.
Sure.
But at the end of the day, I think he has the potential to have a huge bounce back season, and I think Seattle's a great fit for him.
Well, I mean, I haven't thought. I think that, like a lot of people, I haven't really given too much thought to Ray Rice. I wouldn't say that I'd be opposed to having him come, but my thing is, regardless of who the running back is in Seattle, this is why I don't want Seattle to go for a free agent running back. I am willing for Seattle to take a big step back in productivity for a season if they basically redshirted, essentially, Todd Gurley as their next guy. Let Kristen Michael and Robert Turbin be the two running backs working in tandem for a season. Get what you can out of that, and meanwhile, let Todd Gurley rehab his leg fully, and then the next season, let him come out and be the man. Let him carry the load. By all accounts, everybody is saying if there's anybody coming out of college whose style mimics that of Lynch, it is Gurley, and that's why I feel like he would fit into the Seahawks so well. And I think that he is going to fall because of his injury. He's going to fall to a later pick. It just seems to me like at this point, where the Seahawks are and where Gurley is, it seems like this would be a beautiful fit. Like, it just makes sense. Like, this guy's coming off of a pretty bad injury. Pete Carroll is the kind of guy who likes giving people chances. He loves to give people chances. He doesn't look at one thing and be like, oh, nope, you're done, which, you know, makes sense for you to bring up Ray Rice.
Right.
It just seems like, I don't want to say it seems like fate or whatever, like, not all that, but it just seems like the right fit. Like, here is this kid who, before he got hurt, was projected to be, like, the next great running back coming out of college, gets hurt, goes down, people kind of push him off to the side. He's a banger. He's a physical type runner. He fights for extra yards. He's kind of a man of few words, like Marshawn is too. He doesn't talk a whole lot. And I feel like if he came to Seattle and sat behind whoever was running for the team for a year, he could learn a lot. He could rehab. He can get stronger. He can get better. And then he comes out knowing that, you know, the Hawks are going to hand him the reins and be like, all right, you're the man. Let's do it. If I'm a running back, why wouldn't I want to be in that position? That's exactly what I would want. And it just seems like Gurley would be the right fit for the job. That's how I feel about it. In a nutshell. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to see him perform in the combine because he's hurt.
Well, so let me ask you this question in regards to free agency versus draft pick for your team specifically.
Okay.
Is there, again, I said it on the show and I've said it to you a couple times now at this point, I have become a believer in Russell Wilson. Russell Wilson does have, you know, the poise to be able and the ability to be able to lead a team. Hell, you know, that was a great interception.
It was
a very physical play.
Right.
That was a great interception by the Patriots to win that game.
Right.
But my question is, how many of these drives have come off of, especially this past year in the playoffs, were off of Marshawn Lynch doing Marshawn Lynch things, even if it was a pass caught by Russell Wilson? Again, I'm not trying to say this to take away from him, but my question is if you take away the leadership and the skill and the veteran aspect of Marshawn Lynch and you bring in a rookie.
Right.
You're putting a new load on top of Russell Wilson and potentially on a contract year.
Right.
You know, it's like, do you think that Russell Wilson is currently able to take that responsibility on his own?
I mean, I'm just looking at what Russell Wilson has had in the past. Okay. Jermaine Kearse, undrafted free agent. Coming out of Washington, University of Washington.
Yep.
He performed above himself his rookie year. Now, granted, you know, he had some experience, but who was it that caught the game-winning touchdown against Green Bay to get to the Super Bowl? It was Jermaine Kearse.
You're absolutely right.
Who was it that was targeted all four times during all four of those interceptions? It was Jermaine Kearse. I feel like if anybody can use their leadership to kind of help point a player in the right direction and say, look, this is what we need to get done. This is what we need out of you. I'm going to help you get there. I believe it's Russell Wilson. If he can do it with these other guys, if he can do it with people like Kearse, especially after, like I said, four interceptions, two of which were not Russell's fault. It was all on Kearse's drop passes. I mean, at that point, a normal wide receiver, an average wide receiver, well, any wide receiver, really, if you drop two passes in a game that means that much, and those passes result in interceptions, you're hanging your head, you're not believing in yourself. Russell Wilson comes back to him and says, hey, man, I'm going to throw you this game-winning touchdown, and he did it. I feel like having somebody under center like Wilson is so vital. Now, Grant, I'm not taking anything away from Lynch. Lynch,
of course,
is a completely different animal in his own right. Man, like, that's a whole other conversation. But having somebody like Wilson who truly believes in the players that he's playing with, I think just means – it would mean the world to Gurley. I mean, look at Luke Wilson, the tight end. Nobody knew who he was, and all of a sudden he's catching these crazy touchdown passes. And now he's not a household name, but he's well-known up in the Northwest, I'll tell you that much. Everybody knows who Luke Wilson is.
Yeah.
Like Doug Baldwin, I don't think that anybody would know who he was if he wasn't playing for the Seahawks. It's just amazing what this guy Wilson can do to make others look great around. That's what true great players do, true great leaders, is he makes other pieces around him look fantastic.
Absolutely.
He made Jermaine Kearse look fantastic. He's making Luke Wilson look fantastic. Luke Wilson goes to another team, he's falling off the map, I guarantee it.
Does Russell Wilson have that confidence to keep doing that if there's a rookie running back up behind him versus a veteran who he can stand back and be like, you know what, I know this guy's got my back too?
Well, I think he's going to have to because he knows that day is coming when Marshawn's going to eventually just hang up the cleats and they're going to have to pick up somebody, whether it be a rookie or a free agent.
That's why I'm asking you the difference between free agent versus draft pick.
Well, here's my thing. I kind of like the idea of a draft pick because a free agent, if it's a running back free agent and he comes into Seattle and the team says, hey, you know, you're our back, you're the guy, and he looks at Seattle's past and is like, oh, man, the running back runs the show. I think he might come in there with a little bit more, you know, I'm in the driver's seat kind of mentality than what he should, as opposed to a rookie who says, all right, QB, tell me what you want me to do. Where do you want me at? What do you want me to do? How do you want me to block? How do you want me to catch? Where do you want me to run? This is your show. I'm just a part of it. That's kind of what I think the benefit of having a rookie would be.
Fair enough.
Yeah. That's my take.
Well, not to cut off all the seriousness or anything like that, but there is one story coming out of the combine that I think is probably the most important story out of a combine ever.
Oh, no. What is it?
In my entire life. And that is the fact that allegedly and apparently, Jameis Winston has small hands. And all
that
I can
means
think
so
about
much.
Are those amazing Burger King commercials where the guy wants the Whopper and he says, well, I don't want a Whopper. Well, why not? I got these small hands. Oh, it's just, it's too funny to me. It takes it back to that, you know, that Brandon Marshall little tidbit. It's like, any news seems to be important news.
Anything, especially at this point in the offseason. Any little nugget that you can throw out there is the headline story. It doesn't matter what it is. It's making the news.
It was the headline. So much so that they did a little, ESPN did an infographic on it talking about the quarterbacks with small hands that have not, you know, succeeded in the NFL.
Man.
It's just like, it was, 3 years ago we were about how Russell Wilson was too short to win a Super Bowl.
Right.
Like, players play football. He's been playing football with small. He's lost, in the last 8 years of his high school, or 8 years, but last 6 years of his high school and collegiate football, I think he lost 2 games.
Yeah, you're right. I think that's
I think he lost. They hyped up, and I hadn't heard that before the Rose Bowl, but they hyped up that game that he lost at the state championship in high school,
right.
And then he lost against the Ducks in the Rose Bowl. Like, did he look like, short of when he kind of had that weird Tony Romo-esque fumble, did it really look like his hands have ever been a problem?
I mean, winners just win, man, and players play, and that's that. People just read into things that are as much to do about nothing.
So much to do about nothing.
You know, we're just gonna go ahead and end the show there because we're just gonna get down. we're going down a really slippery slope here. We're just gonna get into some, all kinds of ridiculousness. So we're just gonna go ahead and end it there. And on behalf of my
everybody, everybody's patience on waiting for us. We were getting some things done to hopefully bring you a better sounding show, a better quality show. So we appreciate your patience and tuning back in definitely.
And we're definitely gonna keep on working on that. The quality can never.
Anything for the fans.
Anything. Of course. It's all about the people, baby. All right.
All right, guys. We look forward to talking to you next week.
All right. Hit us up on Twitter, man. Hit us up on Twitter and Facebook. We're there. Live. We're active. So, that's the show, and we'll be back again next week.